This God is a messy God. This God is a God who doesn't have things all antiseptic. Some people's faith dream of this orderly way of things happening. And we do have in the Bible some things about God's people that shows us that they are special. But we have tons more things in this book that shows us how these people are just like any people. Corrupt, evil, conniving, da-da-da-da-da-da. So what the book of Genesis is basically about in the end is not these people, but how God works through these people, how God is present in, with, and under, no matter who we are, that we can maybe actually believe that God can work through Darius, that God can be a part and who of what and I'm about, even when I tomorrow blow it, I can actually reconnect with God and continue the next day. If all these people, as we think about, at least some people who have not studied Genesis, think about the patriarchs as these huge people in history who've done these miraculous things, lived hundreds of years, at least more than 100 years, and have done all these, you almost create this image in your psyche that these are people who aren't like us. And when you study these texts, you discover that there are some commonalities there between you and them. And I find that wonderfully refreshing. There's a lot of differences too, but that's just the one thing. As we move into the Joseph narratives, what we see here is a hidden God. In all the patriarchs before, God spoke, God dealt directly. Here all of a sudden, you go through all this, these 12 chapters, and God doesn't just come like a lightning bolt and says, here I am, do this, do this, do this. It's in dreams, and it's in dreams you don't even understand what they're probably all saying. And maybe if somebody could turn, you can all turn and somebody read Chapter 37, verse 5 through 9. If somebody could read those, the initial dreams of Joseph. Those dreams we don't understand fully what those dreams are until chapter 50. So I did want to give you this quick overview. Who has it and who would like to read it? Okay, good.
Once Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, listen to this dream that I dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright. Then your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. His brother said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us? So they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. He had another dream and told it to his brothers, saying, look, I have had another dream. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me.
The key operative word in these dreams is bow. Here we have, some people said he had a strong ego. That's probably an understatement. But somehow this character, this youngster, hey, brothers, guess what? I had this dream in which you, didn't really say you, but it meant you. You were bowing down to me. They hated him for that. How dare this upstart think like this? But, and I'll read this, because it's short. Chapter 50, verse 18. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him, and said, we are here as your slaves. Dream came true. all of a sudden, and plus the other part of this bowing down stuff, which we're going to be getting into now, is that it's not only his brothers, but it's the empire who bows down. It is Egypt itself that bows down before Joseph. And let's hear this passage. It starts on 39:1.
The whole story is impossible.
The wall comes up heaven and chases the bounty.
We have the mountain that they back to explode.
It is on the wall.
I've seen great confidence.
God creates peace and creates.
The call and promise.
God still hope.
Jacob had many sons. But Joseph was the son of Jacob's old age, and he loved him more than all, and gave him a coat of many brilliant colors. Joseph's brothers saw this, and they hated him even more when he told them, "I had a dream, and in my dream we were binding grain in the field. My sheaves stood very straight, while your sheaves fell to mine." One day the brothers saw Joseph walking in his coat of many colors. They tore it off him and threw him into a pit, and they sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver. Joseph was brought down into Egypt, and Potiphar, the captain of Pharaoh's guard, brought Joseph to his house and put him in charge of all he owned. Joseph was young and beautiful to look at. Potiphar's wife had eyes for him, and one day she called out to him, "Lie with me." Time and time again, Joseph refused. "My master has given me everything he owns except you. How could I do this and sin against God?" But Potiphar's wife didn't give up. One day when they were alone in the house, she grabbed Joseph by his coat. As Joseph fled, the garment tore off in her hand. That evening, Potiphar's wife showed it to her husband, saying, "That Hebrew servant tried to lie down with me." Potiphar was furious and sent Joseph to prison. But the Lord was with him. And because of this, the chief jailer put all the other prisoners in Joseph's hands, and Joseph interpreted many dreams for them. In time, Pharaoh himself had a troubled dream, and Joseph was brought up from the dungeon to interpret it. 7 cows came up from the Nile, and they were fat and fair. 7 other cows came up from the Nile, and they were lean and straggly. The 7 lean cows devoured the fat ones. 7 ears of corn grew on a stalk, and they were full and healthy. 7 ears of corn shriveled and scorched by the east wind sprung up and devoured the good ones. This was Pharaoh's dream. Joseph told Pharaoh it was a message from God. 7 years of abundance are coming to Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow and destroy the land. Pharaoh must appoint a discerning and wise overseer so the people will store food in the good years and keep it for the bad. That way, Egypt will not perish. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "No one is as wise as you. You will come to my house, and I will put you in charge of the land of Egypt." Pharaoh gave Joseph his signet ring, a gold chain, and a chariot. And during those years, Joseph had 2 sons by his Egyptian wife. The first was named Manasseh, which means God made him forget his toil in his father's house. And the second was Ephraim, because Joseph said, "God made me fruitful in the land of my affliction."
Anything jumps out at you? Anything you've never heard before? How many of you heard the story before?
Well, I'm not going to say I never read the Bible. I'm going to raise my hand.
Well, let's get into it and see what I think then. Potiphar's wife. She doesn't have a name for some reason. I probably shouldn't say this because some of you may pick up on this, but Phyllis Tribble in the afternoon, a tape that we'll be hearing, She just thinks this is a misogynist text that is just puts women down and in bad light. And how dare this almost even be in the Bible? There's a big debate going on about all that sort of stuff. And the bottom line that what I want to say is yes, this is most certainly true. But the point of the story is not Potiphar's wife, but what Potiphar's wife represents. And maybe the story could have been written differently to make that point across, and I sometimes wish it would have been. But as Walter Brueggemann has said time and time again, this is the story we've got. This is the only story we have, and we must discover how God is in this story. And Phyllis Tribble doesn't buy that argument, but come this afternoon and listen to that. Joseph was what? Handsome and good looking. Isn't one of those enough? I mean, beautiful and gorgeous. I don't know what's the difference between them. There are two Hebrew words there. There are two things. They're trying to make a distinction. Somebody in the first class said, "Well, there is beauty in a sense that there's this inner sense of who a person is." And then there's this objective, outside, physical beauty. Yeah, that could be.
I've heard people say, you make your own face.
You make your own face.
Face.
Oh, God, I don't know.
It's true. That's really true. No matter what you are physically, if that inner comes out, in some way or other, the frown, the smile, the whatever is inside of you comes out, and it changes. Mm-hmm.
Somebody said in the first hour that he might have been a knockout to look at. You know, let's say, you know, let's objectify him now. You know. But what some people are attracted to is that this person knew how to make money. This person knew how to keep books. This person was sharp and shrewd. This person had a mind too. This person, Potiphar said, just take care of all my stuff. You do it better than I do, so just go ahead and take care of it all. Everything but my wife, of course. And of course, when you hear that, at least when some people hear that, as back to the Garden of Eden, any of these trees can be yours, but this tree in the middle. So now we have Adam dealing with the same temptation. Again, here. Everything is yours in my house, but. And of course, Joseph fares a little bit better than Adam here. What I really like about this text, what I did not understand until I started restudying this, is once again, Walter Brueggemann gets credit for this insight. Walter Brueggemann says this story is not a story about Potiphar's wife. It's a story about the empire. And what we have here is the empire wanting everything that there is. Potiphar's wife, in one sense, is a metaphor for that. So much so that in verse 12, she caught hold of his garment. And takes his possession. But Joseph is not taken. Some people can be bought. Some people, you can take anything away and everything away, but some people still have some sort of integrity after that. When she grasps her hand, as it says, grasps to get Joseph, what she's left with is only his clothing. Somehow, Joseph Brueggemann says, has his integrity intact, although he is without clothes. The emperor has no clothes. Remind me about that shirt later. Some of you have heard it, but I want to, if we have time, I want to close with that shirt, a shirt story too. Jacob remains Jacob in the midst of all this. The clothes do not make the man.
Joseph.
No, Joe, I get all these J's mixed up. Thank you. Thank you. If you see me when I'm talking, all of a sudden I look down, because I have this learning disability. You know, why do they name them J's? You know, they just change their names around. But yes, thank you. Whenever I do that again, you correct me. Joseph! Yes. Then, of course, what happens? The rest of it's fairly predictable. The scorned one becomes the accuser. He tried to sleep with me, and I refused. She did? This person I entrusted? And what happens to him?
He's thrown in jail.
Here, this slave who was thrown in the well, brought up out of the well, then was sold into slavery and somehow got into Potiphar's household, now, and prospered very nicely, now was thrown back into the well again. Thrown back into at least another dungeon. And for 2 years, he's there. But he does okay. He's kind of a nice guy. He's kind of a smart-witted guy. He makes friends with the jailer, and he interprets some dreams and all that, which is chapter 40, which we're skipping over. And what we see here, what we see here is the dream of Pharaoh in verse 41. Now, after 2 years, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile. What's the Nile?
Main river in Egypt.
The source of life. This just ain't any old river. It's kind of like the Jordan, and crossing over the Jordan just isn't any... Whenever you see that in the New Testament, the Jordan, when you cross over, it just isn't any. You're entering the Promised Land. There's a whole bunch of stuff. But for the Egyptians, the Nile was their source of life. As the Nile goes, so does Egypt. When the Nile dies, Egypt dies. Because Egypt would not be Egypt without the mother Nile. And so what we have here, when you see that word Nile, it's just not, what's our creek down here? Railroad Creek. Even though I don't know what Holden would be without Railroad Creek. We get our power and everything else. What? Oh, okay. So here we have this, and any of you remember the how many cows there were?
In this? Seven.
And what kind of cows were those? Seven?
Sleek and fat.
Sleek and fat. Isn't that an interesting word? Sleek and fat. I wish I could be sleek and fat. You know, I don't know what that means, but it means that they're in good shape. And as we like cows to be, they had lots of meat on them too, or something. They were just sleek and fat. And then what comes after them?
Ugly and thin.
And how many of those?
Seven.
Seven ugly and thin. And what do this ugly and thin ones do?
They eat
the fat ones. Now, I wish we had never read this story and know the punchline. I would say, now, let's interpret that dream. In fact, you know, then there's the ears of the grain of corn and all that too, the 7 years, but it basically means the same thing, I think. And each time, the Pharaoh wakes up and wonders what's going on, goes back to sleep, and then has another seven and seven that devour the other. The plants devour the other, and wakes up. What does this mean? What does this mean? So Pharaoh, as pharaohs do, and by the way, emperors have a wonderful way of living in an isolated life. Nobody really wants to bear bad news to them. They try to cover up, they try to put the positive twist on everything. But what does Pharaoh do when he wakes up?
He called for the magicians and all the wise men.
Yeah. And they didn't bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh either. He calls for anybody who was anybody, who had insights, who had power to maybe interpret these dreams. He pulled together all the philosophers from the lovely state of Wisconsin because they would understand. They are the wise guys here. They would figure this out. And they got there and Pharaoh says, David, tell me what this is all about. I don't know. What are we going to do? Sorry, David. What are we going to do here? I brought together everybody I knew who could possibly interpret this dream, and nobody can interpret it. What does it mean? I know somebody. He's down in one of your jails. He could interpret my dreams. Maybe he could help you. The hiddenness of God is amazing. How would you have ever thought that being thrown into a well would bring you out of the well, sold into slavery, you make it kind of big, then so you're falsely accused, you're thrown back into a dungeon, and all this somehow brings you before Pharaoh. Somehow is God doing something here that we're not even aware of? And how often in our lives, if we look back in our lives, do we see how God is working? But it sure doesn't feel like it when it's happening, right? So, Joseph decides to clean himself up to meet with Pharaoh. Cleans himself up and comes before Pharaoh. And what happens? He interprets his dream.
Yeah.
Yep. Now you see, the best wisdom of Egypt, let's call it, was dysfunctional. Couldn't really pull all this stuff together. And now we have Pharaoh here, and now we have Joseph interpreting this dream. And do you all know, remember the interpretation? There'll be seven good years. There'll be wonderful years, better years than we've ever had, followed by seven terrible, terrible years. Oh, no. You know, maybe I should only run for one more term and leave it to the next. Leave it to the next Pharaoh. It's kind of like our budgeting processes in Washington here. You know, we're going to have a great 4 years here. Leave it to the next guy to clean it up. Thanks, Reagan.
However, before he does that, he blames it on God. I mean, he says it's not I that's going to interpret your dream. God's going to do it for you. So
well, yeah, or yeah, you could interpret it that way, or you could interpret it by how he subliminally plants the word of God into all of this. Listen to this. In verse 16, God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. 25. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Verse 28, God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Verse 32, the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. I mean, yeah, you could call it passing the buck, but you could say, Pharaoh, life doesn't begin and end in you. It ends and begins in God. So let's make that perfectly clear. So while he's interpreting this dream about seven good years, he's maybe not so subliminally, but I think it's somewhat subliminally, trying to underscore the point here that it is God who is in charge of all of this stuff.
To God be the glory, you say.
To God, yeah, well, yeah, you're right. To God, yeah, to be, the power of God, basically, is contrasted with the feeble power of Pharaoh. What makes God true here is that God can create a future. Somehow, God is the one who creates the future. Stop me if I said this hour. I think I said it last hour. The wonderful thing about the book of Genesis is that it is a story about God, not about us. It is God who makes the future, most often in spite of us, not because of us. That's the one underlying thing. And this is not, and this is why I wanted to use this text today, even though Bill Moyers uses it too, this is not a marginal incident in the Bible. It's a very enormous claim that's happening here. The very premise of much of our biblical faith, that God has the capacity to work newness, to make newness against every sort of convention we try to give out. God is at work in the very existence of our lives and in the very essence of Pharaoh's life. And we don't really see that often. And that's what this dream is all about. Besides 7 good years and 7 bad years. And then what we were talking about yesterday, and the day before, and the day before, and the day before, it seems like every day we mention it, that somehow God is acting. And everybody says, if people would just get out of the way, if people would just not act, if people could just wait and wait upon the Lord, then things would get better. But we are just all these impatient people. And that could be true, but what happens if you just wait? And this is, it's here. Whenever you see the word therefore, verse 33, pay attention. The dream is interpreted, now therefore. Joseph is not only the dream interpreter, but by the way, I have a concrete follow-up plan for you. I can tell you, I can not only tell you what the dream means, but I can tell you what to do with the dream. You assemble all these wise people. The wisest people you have. Wisest people I have. I just said that there's nobody here is very wise. They're all a bunch of jerks. They couldn't understand what we were talking about.
This is a job interview then.
Pardon?
This is his job interview.
Well,
yeah.
I kind of think so. Most of the interpreters that I've been reading about this tends to say that he doesn't self-promote himself. He just kind of states the facts and lets Pharaoh make the connections. But I think he's a little shrewder than that. And I think he's kind of trying to say, because he's just know that the wisest of all were assembled and they couldn't figure out. And then I'm coming here. Now not only will I interpret your dream, but I'll tell you what to do. So what does he tell them?
Point somebody to gather everything in.
Yeah. What we have to do is we have to hoard. We have to save. We have to pile up because we'll have such abundant years here. We'll gather all these things up, save all these things. Then for during the lean years, we can start dishing all that stuff out. And we need somebody to oversee all this stuff. We need somebody who is shrewd enough, who has a business sense enough, in that sense, beautiful enough to do all this.
During this period, was Pharaoh considered a god in the Egypt? I mean, had they gotten that far along?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, they were.
Well, he was definitely Mr. Powerful. And my guess would be yes, but I really don't know. But I think he was still in this period fairly divine. Yeah.
Because if he was, now Joseph is really treading on deep water.
Well, yes and no, but there are many gods. You know, Israel's claim is for one God, the monotheistic God. So who cares if you're talking about another God? But Joseph is treading because Joseph's saying, my God. Not you, my God. This God can help you out. So you know, it's and then you can see how the Islamic faith picks this up, and that's why Joseph is so well thought of. Because you know they are a monotheistic faith too, and Joseph is the person who comes to Egypt who brings this God to them, and so that's kind of cool. I mean. Abraham was there first, but he was surviving.
Another question.
Sure.
It's always bothered me that it's a God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why Jacob was in there, and I realize I promised him, but not Joseph. You know, because Joseph was a person of integrity. Might have a little pride, but.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says this, you know, you'd think if you were going to mention him in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews, they'd say, oh yeah, Joseph remained faithful to God during those times in the pits.
Mm-hmm.
And here it says in
Hebrews. That's good. They were the pits. I like that.
Yeah. 11:22. By faith, Joseph at the end of his life made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave instructions about his burial, meaning Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't Joseph a hero of faith to the Israelites like he is to the Islam people?
Well, I would think he is, but and I don't know chapter and verse, and in him you know it, that phrase, the God of, I think he makes. Joseph is the one who makes it, I think, somewhere in here, because he wasn't going to add himself, that I am connected here. So in one sense, by making that statement, you are honoring, because Joseph is the one who first. If you have to give quotes around it, you have to said by Joseph. The other thing is, the other thing I could say is that those were the ones who last spoke to God. These, the ones who had some sort of connection to God in ways other than the hiddenness. And Joseph is the first one who deals with God in the same way that we deal with God, somewhat revealed, but not totally revealed. And so therefore, there's a separation there. And the third and final thing I would say is that this story is in chapter 50, the end of Genesis, is where Joseph's father was buried. That this is a continuation of his cycle, his narrative. And in fact, because we probably won't get to it, I think I find it very interesting that the last chapter of the book of Genesis. And Joseph died being 110 years old. He was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. In the beginning, God created. Go through all this stuff. The whole wonderful book of Genesis. And you get all the way over here. And it ends with the coffin in Egypt. The true promise of the land is yet to come. A lot of stuff happens here. But it's just, what a way. I mean, don't you just hate novels that end that way? I want it all wrapped up. I want the promised land. I want the parting of the Red Sea. I want, I want Jesus coming. I want the lion and the lamb lying down with each other. I want, I want revelations. I want it all. Not embalmed in a coffin in Egypt. But I don't know where that came from. But anyway, there we are. God's purpose is not the end of human planning, but the ground of it. This is back. We cannot just think, and it came up so often, so I want to reiterate it one more time. We cannot just think that what the book of Genesis is teaching us is that we just have to learn to shut up and adjust and wait for the Lord. The book of Genesis is telling us we have to discern who and what the Lord is talking to us about. And then we have to act. And this is what Joseph does. Joseph learns to discern what's going on and has an action plan. And we have to discover that action plan. I think I said it earlier this week, but the thing about the river of life, God flows through history. And cheap grace is staying on the river bank and watching and saying, there goes God. Grace is saying, there's God, and jumping in. And embracing God. That's the action. I think God is there. And that grace is costly. That is risky. And you jump. And sometimes it is God. And sometimes what you think was what was God's will was not.
and you get back up on the riverbank and you look again for God. It's this type of action that I see in the book of Genesis, trying to perceive how God is working. Any of you read the book by Leslie Weatherhead, The Will of God? It's a short little book. I've been trying, and maybe I'll resurrect this project. I want to publish a book someday, an annotated bibliography of the 100 best books under 100 pages. Now I want to give one page to each book, so my book will make the list. Yeah. Mine will be number 100. This is one of them. Leslie Weatherhead says that people confuse the will of God, and they think the will of God is one thing. There's actually three wills of God. There is the intentional will of God, what God intends for all people. I intend that you be fruitful and multiply, that you live in our land, this is what I want for you. I want you to be one with me. That's what I intend. Then there is the second will of God. There is the circumstantial will of God. But somehow, because of human freedom, sin, whatever you want to call it, things run amok. By the way, these are, I think, 5 sermons he gives, Leslie Weatherhead. Things run amok. Things just don't turn out. And so, Jesus is crucified. That's a circumstantial will of God. In order that the ultimate will of God, number 3, will be done. I don't think, this is my philosophy here, I don't know if truly Joseph was supposed to be thrown into the pits. I don't know that. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know if it's a little good. But the ultimate will of God is that he was going to bring God to Egypt. That's what God wanted. And so, gets in the pits. Well, out of the circumstances, we'll work this out somehow. And that's how the will of God works. It's not just this, if I can only reveal what is God's plan for my life, then all will be hunky-dory. Uh-uh. I am convinced that I could do one of, I don't know, let's say 10 things, and God's will be done if I choose any one of those, if I'm perceptive to how God is working in my life. It's not just one road, and if I somehow take the wrong road, I am condemned and damned for all eternity. I can take that road, and all of a sudden I can discover who and what God is on that road, or that road, or that road, or that road. It's not the road you take. It's not the path you take as much as it is how you feel God's presence. Does this make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Very much so.
Any of you want to say BS? No, you wouldn't say that. Okay, where are we here? Now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a man who is discerning and wise. We found out in verse 8 there was no one such person. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers. People who are discreet and wise bear the mark of discernment and shrewdness and who fears God. Basically what this is saying. This is not only a description of the right man, but it's almost a new ruling agenda. This is how life is going to be at this time. So Pharaoh says to his servants, terrible translation, is to his council. But of course, his council were his servants. But you kind of, if you're not aware of that, you think these are these butlers. You know, this is his council. These are the elite of the people. You know, maybe Potiphar himself was there. I don't know. Can we find anyone else like this one, in whom is the Spirit of God? Guess not. So they put him in charge of everything. And then there's this wonderful, we tried to do this yesterday when I was Harold the Herald. It's called enthronement. If we look verses 41 and follow for the 45. It's a litany of installation. Here we have Joseph being literally enthroned to be second only to Pharaoh. You have the royal proclamation, verse 41. You have the insignia of the office, verse 42. You have the public acclamation, verse 43. He's given a new royal name, which everybody has forgotten, by the way, which is probably okay.
You can't pronounce it.
Do you wanna? Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody read that. What's his name? I don't have it in front of me, so I can't read it.
Zafapananina.
I don't know how to pronounce it either. No wonder he went by Joseph.
No wonder.
Kind of sometimes some names stick. Then he is married, legitimacy of marriage here. Then there's a cry of acclamation rendered that, by the way, most commentaries say the real meaning of this is this awkward phrase has been lost. Bow the knee. Mm-hmm. Or bow the knee. What is it? And should be in 45. Is it even in this translation?
Thus Joseph being authority with the land of Egypt.
45, let me look here. Oh, there it is, 43. And they cried out in front of him, bow the knee. You know, I don't know if it's kind of like I was trying to do yesterday when I had everybody bow. You know, is it this sort of thing? He became, for all practical purposes, an Egyptian here. He assimilated. Do you think he's a good model for refugees today?
Yes.
Do you think that refugees might actually look at this guy and say, hey, you know, maybe there's some hope for us? Or do you think he's a lousy model because leads false hope? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, if all you gotta do is be the perfect citizen, turn down the good lie with the woman, and be loyal, do everything right, mm-hmm. lose your
coat. Yeah, be good looking and beautiful and all inside and outside.
Lose your coat, which was what their wife remembers you for, and all you gotta do is be pretty near perfect, and you know what? We'll accept you. Mm-hmm.
And be in line with God's will.
There's the biggie.
Yeah, we're pretty good with refugees. They only have to measure up to that.
Yep. We call it the American way.
Right.
And we'll let how many thousand of them in, and the rest of don't measure, we don't let in. Yes, over here and then over here.
The one thing that you said that intrigued me a while back is that Joseph brought God Egypt. So this kind of becomes a missionary thing that mm-hmm. he's doing. Mm-hmm. Kind of unwilling on his part. He doesn't really have the concept of what's going on, but he's bringing God to Egypt. And actually, it also seems to be an instance where a city and a nation is being saved by God.
I'm facetious here to your comment, so I don't want to lose your comment, which is right on. A doctor said to me once, a medical doctor said to me once when we were just changing our church name to the Evangelical Lutheran Church. He says, what's evangelical about Lutherans?
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't hitting it. You know, do you really, we really know how to practice the hiddenness of God. I go to the church down there. If anything, Joe, back to your point, he has a way, he is going as a missionary, even though he does not know it. Even though Pharaoh does not know that. I don't think he knows that. I think as he looks back upon it, it is seen and it's noticed. And so I think that's good. You had a comment?
Oh, just about your comment about is this a good story of refugees? It reminds me of the story of Henry Kissinger. If you think about it.
Tell me. I don't.
I came to this country as a refugee. Worked his way up, started as an advisor to the president. Eventually, he became the Secretary of State and probably the second most powerful.
That's really true. Yeah. In fact, they even talked about having a constitutional amendment. to allow a non-native to run for president. That was because of Henry Kissinger. That would, in some ways, that, knowing Henry Kissinger, who has the ego but not all the other attributes of Joseph, I'd be very tight. I wouldn't want to make too much out of it. Over here and then over here.
I wonder if when Joseph marries the daughter of the priest of Han, if that kind of contaminates him a bit, or is it like Solomon, where he kind of dabbles in Egyptian religion, or is it outside
Let me just tease you that for to come back at 1 o'clock. Not only is this a sexist story, this story is elitist, and it's also racist. It is the form of you know who's better, who's not, and it's terrible in that sense, and they struggle with this, and there's no resolve on what this all means, but does it, to think in our day and age, would we say that about somebody? You contaminated me because I am the offspring of a mixed breed or something, but that almost seems natural to say that here. It really, I have a funny story. I was part of the Jewish Christian Dialogues several years back, and I heard this woman speak. And she said she was a Gentile who fell in love with a Jew. And she decided that she wanted to be Jewish. So she went to the rabbi, and after years and years, she finally converted. And her question then to her husband was, I can't remain married to you. I, as a Jew, can't remain married to anybody who would marry a Gentile. She became a better Jew! it's just bizarre how those things work out. But that's part of that, that's in the psyche, that's in our culture. Where? Oh, yeah.
I'm amazed that here we have in Egypt 7 years of prosperity, and there, during the 7 years of prosperity, Joseph has talked him into saving, to hoarding for this that has not occurred, and they've given him all of this power and this glory, and he hasn't done anything. I mean, they don't know whether.
That's really true. What if the next 7 years were just more, and all that stuff has to rot? Yeah, that's really true. That's a good point. But once again, is this prescriptive or descriptive? These stories are written from here, looking back on it, and how all that stuff evolved. I don't know, but that's why it's in the book, because it was true. I wonder how many of his dreams did not make it. Could be blasphemy if it's so. The what?
It's 2020 hindsight. I mean, it's a lot of recreation too, I
believe. Yeah.
Probably what happened. Mm. Well, I don't think a refugee could pull that off in this country.
Henry Kissinger almost did.
No, I mean, in terms of, well, we were in trouble.
Yeah. Well, they were. Pharaoh couldn't figure out anything. He brought all this after me. Look at the brain drain we had in Germany. where are the United States be without World War II? and everybody, all the refugees that came. I mean von Buren and who else? Yeah, just
Einstein.
Einstein too. Yeah, that's a good one. 2 points in closing, and then we can talk anywhere we want to go with this. I titled this series Children of Eden, not only because it was kind of catchy, I kind of like it, not only because the musical is called Children of Eden, but as I chose it and then started studying with it, I want us to realize that when we study Scripture, that we are children of Eden. And that means that we're not just children of the Risen One, who we are. But the Old Testament is not an ancient book with outdated stuff. but we can find ourselves in it. That old means respected, full of wisdom and insight, and not old meaning has been passé. That in this Hebrew Bible are wonderful things, and that we are as much a part of this story, not only because we have siblings that we rage against, that there are favorites and there is all sorts of evil and all sorts of good and all that, but this is our story as well. And I hope and I pray that in studying this, you have found a new appreciation, or at least in listening, a new appreciation for Hebrew scripture. It's marvelous. There is grace here. We always say, oh, there's law. You know, there is God is at work here in strange and beautiful ways too. Second and last, for those of you who heard this last Friday, with such a good story, I want to tell it again. And it does have something to do with the hiddenness of God and how God works. This could be a metaphor of this story that we've been talking about. How God seems not to be part of your life, and then all of a sudden you see it, and then you don't see it, and then you see it, and that's how we go through our lives. 1982, I was what they then had a title called Village Philosopher up here. Maybe it was 84 this happened, I'm not sure. It was either 82 or 84. I was up here, led an evening forum, and like I normally do when those forums get hot and stuff, I take off my outer shirt and lay it somewhere. And I came back the next morning to pick it up, and it was gone. I looked in the lost and found, couldn't find it, went back the next day, couldn't find it. As we left, I left a note for the registrar or whoever was in charge of lost and found. Because the shirt that I had lost was a very important shirt to me. It was the only piece of clothing that my father had that I still have. He was not into neat corduroy, but he was into other polyester stuff. But this one I thought I wanted to keep. And I had it for about 10 years when he after he died, and I lost it up here. And I was depressed and I was sad. I mean, I knew this shirt had this little white mark on it. I knew this shirt had some frays on it and stuff. So I went back depressed to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Gave it up. Then I moved to St. Cloud, Minnesota. And at worship on a Wednesday night, about this many people, as I was preaching, I kept looking at this person who had my shirt. I says, that could be my, oh, it can't be my shirt. You know, I was trying to keep thoughts on my sermon, but it was still right there. It was still right there. I remember serving communion, and as he walked away, I was looking for that little white spot. And it was there! I knew it was my shirt! My dad's shirt! Afterwards, I said, go in peace and serve the Lord. But hey, you stay. So I asked this person if he had ever been to Holden. His name was Don Shuba. Any of you remember Don Shuba, carpenter, up here for years? He's, yeah, I spent lots of time up at Holden. I said, did you ever get any of your clothes at Holden? I get all my clothes at Holden. here, from the Holden Village to Albuquerque to Minneapolis to St. Cloud, wherever that cycle worked, my shirt, my dad's shirt, was returned to me. And if anybody has a security blanket, if anybody has a little stuffed animal that they like to sleep with and stuff, I sometimes sit and hold my shirt. In fact, All Saints Sunday, I sit in my grandmother. How much time do I have? Well, I sit in my grandmother's rocking chair. My grandmother has and I'll probably hold this shirt now that I'm thinking about this. And I sit in rocking chair, and I remember people who have died. And my grandmother, who sat in his rocking chair for about the last 20 years of her life, I asked her if she ever got depressed sitting in this rocking chair, and she said, "Oh no." She says, this chair, she says, it can go anywhere I want it to go. My mind is alert, and I'm not in this chair all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, so I sit in it and rock in it and tell stories about people who have touched my lives in hopes that they will reconnect with stories of other people in their lives. And there's kind of a joke now in our parish that at the end there's this woman in the back who holds up one Kleenex or three Kleenexes or two. She rates how many Kleenexes she needed during this during the All Saints Sunday ceremony. So after all this is done and we have the silence, and then I get up to to finish the liturgy, she's holding the Kleenexes in the background. She and I smile. I don't think the rest of the people know what's going on. Then the liturgy continues. Thanks for being so much a part of my experience walking through the book of Genesis. It's been wonderful for me. I'm even taking this as continuing education time, because I have learned that if you have to teach this stuff, you have to get into it, and it's definitely a continuing education experience for me. And the insights and the conversations that we've had, that we've had around here has been great. So I thank you, and I'm leaving tomorrow. So
thank you.
Peace be with you.